The Salmon of Doubt, Disc 3.
The Rhino Climb. Great wumps of equatorial heat are coming up at me from off the tarmac. It's the short, rainy season in Kenya, but the sun burned off the morning dampness in minutes. I'm slathered in sunblock. The road stretches off into the distant heat haze and my legs are settling in nicely. Dotted along the road ahead and behind me are other walkers, some striding vigorously, others appearing just to amble, but all in fact moving at the same speed. One of them is wearing a large grey sculptural edifice made out of a painted woven plastic fabric stretched over a metal frame. A large horn bobs along in front of it. The thing is a grotesque but oddly beautiful caricature of a rhinoceros moving along with swift, busy strides. The sun beats down. Lopsided lorries grind their way dangerously past us. The drivers shout and grin at our rhinoceros. When we pass, as we frequently do, lorries that have clearly just rolled over and collapsed on the side of the road, we wonder if it was anything to do with us. The other walkers have all been walking for several days now, from the shore at Mombasa, along the main highway to the truck stop at Voi, the local centre of the universe. I joined them here last night, rattling in by Land Rover from Nairobi with my sister Jane, 28 feet above sea level, which is, in its way, impressive. But if you were going to climb Everest, you would probably start, if you were using a reliable guide, somewhere in the Himalayas. Anywhere in the Himalayas is pretty damn high to start with, and so, to hear some people tell it, it's just a smartish jog to do the last little bit to the actual top of Everest. The way to keep it interesting these days is to do it without oxygen, or in your underpants or something. But Kilimanjaro is not part of a widespread upheaval like Everest. It was a long time before people managed to work out which bit of the Himalayas was actually the highest, and the discovery was finally made, as I recall, on a desk in London. No such problem with Kilimanjaro. It's volcanic, and stands on its own, just lost one of his family. In the long run, conservation can't be imposed by outsiders, overriding the needs of local people. If anyone is going to take care of the wildlife, then, in the end it must be the local people, and someone must take care of them. Our route took us alongside and sometimes through the great national parks of Tsavo East and Tsavo West, and it was the people who lived on these perimeters that we had come to visit and also to help. The £100,000 we were hoping to raise from the walk would be spent on building school classrooms, stocking libraries, and paying for other community projects. We wanted to encourage them to see that whatever problems the wildlife may pose to them, it was of benefit to them as well. As we were approaching our first village of the day, the rhino, with Todd Jones inside it, was in the lead. All the walkers took turns at wearing the thing for an hour at a time, and you quickly learned to tell who was in it at any moment from the way in which it moved. If the rhino sauntered, then it was Giles inside. Giles was an ex-Gordonston Hugh Grant lookalike who had spent the last few years hitchhiking languidly around Africa with his own parachute. His technique was to turn up at airfields with this parachute, find someone who was flying in the general direction he wanted to go, hitch a lift, and then, when the fancy took him, just jump out of the plane. Apparently, his girlfriend was a top supermodel, who every few months would find out where he was, fly out there, and then, I'm guessing here, a succession of animals instead. Any time you see a film or TV show or a commercial which features someone dressed up as an animal, it's probably Todd inside. "I was in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe," he told me. "Guess," he added, "which one I was." One evening he showed me pictures of his family. Here was a beautiful picture of his wife, another of his young daughter, a sweet picture of his baby son, and here was one of Todd himself. Todd was done up, very convincingly, as a bright blue centaur. As Todd Rhino bustled along, suddenly huge crowds of children erupted onto the road ahead of us and hurried towards us, singing and dancing and chanting, "Rhino! Rhino! Rhino!" We were quickly surrounded and escorted the last few hundred yards to where they had prepared a reception for us in the village square. The whole village had turned out to greet us with enormous enthusiasm. We sat and watched, panting in the heat and sluicing ourselves down with bottled water, as the children of the village put on a display of dancing and choral singing that was, frankly, amazing. When I say children, I'm not just talking about 7-year-olds. I'm talking about 17-year-olds as well. It's odd that we don't any more have a comfortable word that covers the whole range. Youngsters? Patronizing. Kids? No. Youths? Sounds as if they've just broken into a warehouse and stolen something. Children, then. The children had written a song about rhinos. Applegate, taking pictures of us with his Canon EOS-1, which I'd been coveting ever since I saw it. Kees, our Dutch video cameraman, hoists his lightweight Sony 3-chip up to his shoulder and pans along the line of walkers. I wonder if there's anywhere in the West that you could find 100 children to sing and dance like that. The following day is my first stint in the rhino suit. I'm much too big for it, and my legs stick out absurdly from the bottom, so that I look like a giant prawn tempura. Inside, the heat and the stench of stale sweat and old Dettol are almost overpowering until you get into the swing of things. Todd walks along beside me, determinedly keeping me engaged in conversation. After a while comes at the end of the week, whereas a fried egg comes out of a hen. Like most things, of course, it isn't quite that simple. The fried egg isn't properly a fried egg until it's been put in a frying pan and fried. This is something you wouldn't do to a Friday, of course, though you might do it on a Friday. You can also fry eggs on a Thursday, if you like, or on a cooker. It's all rather complicated, but it makes a kind of sense if you think about it for a while. It's also good to know the difference between a lizard and a blizzard. This is quite an easy one. Though the two things sound very much alike, you find them in such very different parts of the world that it is a very simple matter to tell them apart. If you are somewhere inside the Arctic Circle, then what you are looking at is probably a blizzard, where it can lead to terrible confusion. Imagine trying to ride a bicycle on a small patch of blue paint, or have to dig up an entire street just to have something to wear if you fancy spending the evening with some druids. Druids used to live thousands of years ago. They used to wear long white robes and have very strong opinions about what a wonderful thing the sun was. Do you know what an opinion is? I expect someone in your family has probably got one, so you could ask them to tell you about it. Asking people about their opinions is a very good way of making friends. Telling them about your own opinions can also work, but not always quite as well. Nowadays, most people know what a wonderful thing the sun is, so there aren't many druids around anymore, but there are still a few traditions. The harpsichord, traditionally, played a supporting role in this kind of group, but not this time. Bach let rip. As you listen to the first movement, you hear something strange, new and terrifying, giving birth to itself. Or maybe it's a giant engine, or even a great horse being prepared for a Herculean task, surrounded by, you can't help jumbling metaphors when language tries to keep up with music, a flotilla of helpers fussing around it. You hear it ticking over, trotting, having a little canter here and there, getting a bit frisky, and then taking a trial run as its helpers encourage it onwards, keening with bated breath. It hauls itself back in again. The familiarity of the Brandenburgs should not blind us to their magnitude. I'm convinced that Bach is the greatest genius who ever walked among us, and the Brandenburgs are what he wrote when he was happy. Is in the house, so forget Frank. You're lucky. You can. Now the point is this. The house is here. Building this house is the purpose of the whole exercise. If I want anything done in it, I pick up the phone, assuming Frank hasn't hacked through the line trying to get at a light switch, and someone comes round to the house and does it. If I want to have some cupboards installed, I don't have to do the following. I want that to happen. I'll tell you all I want to have to do in order to get my portable to appear on the desktop of my 2X. I just want to carry it into the same room. Bang! There it is. It's on the desktop. This is infrared talk. Or maybe it's microwave talk. I don't really care anymore than I want to care about PICTs and TIFFs and RTFs and SILKs and all the other acronyms which merely say, we've got a complicated problem, so here's a complicated answer to it. Let me make one thing clear. I adore my Macintosh, or rather my family of however many Macintoshes it is that I've recklessly accumulated over the years. I've adored it since I first saw one at Infocom's offices in Boston in 1983. The thing that has kept me enthralled and hypnotized by it in all that time is the perception which lies at the heart of its design, which is this. There is no problem so complicated that you can't find a very simple answer to it if you look at it the right way. Or, to put it another way, the future of computer power is pure simplicity. So my two major wishes for the 1990s are that the Macintosh systems designers get back to that future, and that Frank the Vandal gets out of my house. Written in 1989 for Mac User. shocking. It was a typewriter. So we began to develop it as a super typewriter, with a long and increasingly incomprehensible feature list. Users of Microsoft Word will know what I'm talking about. The next breakthrough came when we started to make these numbers, which were now flying round inside these machines at insane speeds, stand for the picture elements of a graphical display. Pixels! Aha, we thought. This machine turns out to be much more exciting even than a typewriter. It's a television, with a typewriter stuck in front of it. And now we have the World Wide Web. The only thing I know of whose shortened form, www, takes 3 times longer to say than what it's short for. And we have yet another exciting new model. It's a brochure! A huge, all-singing, all-dancing, hopping, beeping, flash-ridden brochure. Of course, the computer isn't any of these things. These are all things we were previously familiar with from the real world, which we have modelled in the computer so that we can use the damn thing. Which should tell us something interesting. The computer is actually a modelling device. Once we see that, we ought to realise that we can model anything in it. Not just things we are used to doing in the real world, but the things the real world actually prevents us from. They're very smart like that. They are now able to supply the studios with information about what there is actually demand for out there. And on the basis of another, not entirely disinterested suggestion of mine, they are going to start a running poll on which books people would most like to see turned into movies. This is information that no one has ever been able to collect before. But let us take this one stage further. How often have you looked through a brochure or a catalogue and thought, I wish somebody would write a book about... Or, if only somebody made a bicycle with a... Or, why doesn't somebody make a screwdriver that... Or, why don't they make that in blue? A brochure can't answer you, but the web can. What is the thing you'd really love to have if only someone had the sense to make one? Suggestions, please, to www.h2g2.com. Independent on Sunday. I've come up with a set of rules that describe our reactions to technologies. Rule 1. Anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and is just a natural part of the way the world works. 2. Anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 are new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. 3. Anything invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things. Daughter, when she tells me that she didn't make that mess on the floor. I believe in justice and fair play, though I don't know exactly how we achieve them, other than by continually trying against all possible odds of success. I also believe that England should enter the European Monetary Union. I am not remotely enough of an economist to argue the issue vigorously with someone who is, but what little I do know, reinforced with a hefty dollop of gut feeling, strongly suggests to me that it's the right course. I could very easily turn out to be wrong, and I know that. These seem to me to be legitimate uses for the word believe. As a carapace for the protection of irrational notions from legitimate questions, however, I think that the word has a lot of mischief to answer for. So I do not believe that there is no God. I am, however, convinced that there is no God, which is a totally different stance and takes me on to my second reason. I don't accept the currently fashionable assertion that any view is automatically as worthy of respect as any equal and opposite view. My view is that the moon is made of rock. If someone says to me, well, you haven't been there, have you? You haven't seen it for yourself, so my view that it is made of Norwegian beaver cheese is equally valid. Then I can't even be bothered to argue. There is such a thing as the burden of proof, and in the case of God, as in the case of the composition of the moon, this is... What astonished me, however, was the realization that the arguments in favor of religious ideas were so feeble and silly next to the robust arguments of something as interpretive and opinionated as history. In fact, they were embarrassingly childish. They were never subject to the kind of outright challenge which was the normal stock in trade of any other area of intellectual endeavor whatsoever. Why not? Because they wouldn't stand up to it. So I became an agnostic. And I thought and thought and thought. but I just did not have enough to go on, so I didn't really come to any resolution. I was extremely doubtful about the idea of God, but I just didn't know enough about anything to have a good working model of any other explanation for, well, life, the universe, and everything to put in its place. But I kept at it, and I kept reading, and I kept thinking. Sometime around my early 30s, I stumbled upon evolutionary biology, particularly in the form of Richard Dawkins' books, The Selfish Gene, and then The Blind Watchmaker. And suddenly, on, I think, the second reading of The Selfish Gene, it all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise, naturally, to all of the infinite and baffling complexity of life. The awe it inspired in me made the awe that people talk about in respect of religious experience seem frankly silly beside it. Which characters or situations are your personal religious thoughts most accurately reflected? Douglas. I am fascinated by religion. That's a completely different thing from believing in it. It has had such an incalculably huge effect on human affairs. What is it? What does it represent? Why have we invented it? How does it keep going? What will become of it? I love to keep poking and prodding at it. I've thought about it so much over the years that fascination is bound to spill over into my writing. American Atheists. What message would you like to send to your atheist fans? Douglas. Hello. How are you? From The American Atheist, Volume 37. I tend to be full of predictions of what is going to happen over the course of the following year. 2 days later, of course, they're forgotten, and we never get to test them. So I'd like to invite readers to submit their own predictions, or any others they come across in print, of what is going to happen in the next 5 years and when. Will we set off to Mars? Will we get peace in Ireland or the Middle East? Will the e-commerce bubble burst? We'll put them up on the web, where they will stay for that whole period, so we can track them against what actually happens. Predicting the future is a mug's game, but any game is improved when you can actually keep the score. Independent on Sunday. There's now a new generation of smarter office chair beginning to arrive that makes a virtue of doing away with all the knobs and levers. All the springing and bracing we learned about is still there, but it adjusts to your posture and movement automatically without you having to tell it how to. All right, here's a prediction for you. When we have software that works like that, the world will truly be a better and happier place. Because when the Tsar, I don't know which Tsar it was, because I'm not in my study at home, I'm leaning against something shamefully ugly in Michigan and there are no books, decreed that the Trans-Siberian Railway should be built, he drew a line on a map with a ruler. The ruler had a nick in it. I am writing this article leaning against some nameless architectural mistake, and I am not writing the article. I wasn't going to do that. In the end, I had to buy a US power cable. Or rather, I had to try and buy one. Couldn't be done. They only came with new Mac portables. I heaved a dead Mac portable around with me for 10 days. And occasionally ate my sandwiches off it, because it was slightly lighter than carrying a table. Damn, there goes another one. Saved on duty is going into the coffers of the duty-free shops, rather than helping to pay for the National Health Service and Trident. So why did I buy my Scion at the duty-free shop? Because I'm a complete idiot, that's why. Anyway, status update. They found me a room. I've unpacked my adapter plug. My PowerBook is charging itself up. I'm still not using it, though because I am now lying in the bath. So I'm still using the Scion. I have never ever written anything in the bath before. Paper gets damp and steamy. Pens won't write upside down. Typewriters hurt your tummy. And if you are prepared to use a PowerBook in the bath, then I assume that it isn't your own PowerBook. So the thing is, it can be done. You can actually write on a palm-top computer, which is something I didn't realize before. I had tried to do it on a Sharp Wizard, but it wasn't possible because the keyboard was laid out alphabetically, which is hopeless. The principle behind the decision to have an alphabetical keyboard is based on a misunderstanding. I believe that the idea is this. Not everybody knows QWERTY. It's an odd feeling, actually, typing QWERTY as a word. Try it and you'll see what I mean. But everybody knows the alphabet. This is true, but irrelevant. People know the alphabet as a one-dimensional string, not as a two-dimensional array. So you're going to hunt and peck anyway. So why not use QWERTY and let people who know it have the benefit? I also tried the larger Sharp Wizard, the 8200, which does have a QWERTY keyboard, but no word wrap. Can you believe that? Even Etch-A-Sketch has word wrap these days. And keyboard input, for the moment, means QWERTY. But QWERTY, as we know, was originally designed to slow down typists so the keys wouldn't jam. It's deliberately inefficient. However, all attempts to replace it with something more efficient, like the Dvorak keyboard, have failed. People know QWERTY already, and they don't have any pressing incentive to change. Dvorak et al. May be better, but QWERTY is, or has been till now, good enough. If it ain't bust, don't fix it, is a very sound principle, and remains so, despite the fact that I have slavishly ignored it all my life. I think, though, that we might finally have arrived at a point at which there is a strong incentive to reinvent the keyboard. Palm-top computers are where all the new action is. Apple and Microsoft and everybody are suddenly beginning to get revved up about personal digital assistants and stuff. And having been used like Branwell Bronte, I'm not expecting to do the same trick again tomorrow. Independent on Sunday. We notice things that don't work. We don't notice things that do. We notice computers. We don't notice pennies. We notice e-book readers. We don't notice books. An awful lot of the little dongly things, including the one that arrived this morning, are little dongly things that run on 120 volts AC, American voltage, which means I can't use them here in foreign state code FN. But I have to keep them in case I ever take the gizmo to which they fit, provided I know which gizmo it amps. They have positive tips and negative sleeves on their plugs, unless they are the type that has negative tips and positive sleeves. By the time you multiply all these different variables together, you end up with a fairly major industry, which exists, so far as I can tell, to fill my cupboards with little dongly things, none of which I can ever positively identify without playing gizmo Pelmanism. The usual method of finding a little dongly thing that actually matches a gizmo I want to use is to go and buy another, at a price that can physically drive the air from your body. Would be that you would only need one DC power adapter. Think of that! Well, not exactly one, you might need a dozen of them, but they would all be exactly the same. Just get a box of them. They'll... Yes, yes, I know that there are all sorts of power user strategies you can use to extend your battery life, dimming modes, RAM disks, processor resting, and so on, but the point is that I really can't be bothered. I'm perfectly capable of just reading the in-flight magazine if I want to be irritated. However, if there was a DC power supply in my armrest, I would actually be able to do some work, or at least fiddle with stuff. I know that the airline companies will probably say, yes, but if we do that, our aeroplanes will fall out of the sky. But they always say that. I know that sometimes their planes do fall out of the sky, but, and here's the point, not nearly as often as the airline companies say they will. I, for one, would be willing...